Hi, I'm William Tullett from Anglia Ruskin University in Cambridge.
And I'm Hannah McCann from the University of Melbourne in Australia.
And welcome to the Pandemic Sensory Archive, a collection of voices from sensory experts on the fate of the five senses during and after the COVID-19 pandemic.
This project has been sponsored by the British Academy, and we hope that you enjoy the interview. Great. So just to start us off with, do you want to introduce yourself and give us a sense of your expertise when it comes to taste?
I'm Evangeline Mansouris. I've been a accredited practicing dietitian now for over 30 years. And I've worked a lot in university settings as an academic, teaching, as well as doing some research. I've also worked in some of the large major teaching hospitals here in Adelaide, as well as having had my own private practice. And I guess the other highly relevant thing is that I'm also a mum and, I cook meals along with my husband, so also a major, food preparer and cooking. So, sort of come from food from both angles, I guess. And, when you're providing meals and food to family, that's also, quite important. But the reality is everybody does that. So everybody has an opinion on food and diet. And that's one of the interesting things about working in this space is that everybody has an opinion about food and nutrition and diet. But what's really interesting is hearing about people's perceptions about food and how they feel it links to their health, but also the importance that food has in our culture.
Oh, I'm so interested in that idea that everyone has these kind of strong opinions about food and health. I mean, in your practice, like, does that present a lot of challenges because people think?
It certainly does. So, and it's a fair enough assumption because, and this is one of the things that I think is important about when we look at what's happened with food and taste and recipes and meals and cooking during COVID-19 is that food is a basic need, as we see in Maslow's hierarchy of needs, which lists it right at the bottom, as physiological needs, along with having a shelter, having access to water, being safe, and having safe access to food. So it's not a surprise that people have their own perceptions about food. And a lot of this is built up, during their formative years with what family tells them, what the cultural beliefs are around food, and also probably the religious significance of some food. So we know a lot of different cultures and different religions have rules around food and fasting as well. So you can understand why people do. And that's great because it makes everybody interested in food. And I guess the difficulty comes when you have to overlay that with the science. And the science means what is the evidence base that guides us to telling people with certain health conditions what they need to eat. And that often may not be the same as people's cultural beliefs. And so there's always the challenge there about how you talk to people about, well, we know that you feel this about this particular food, but the science really tells us this, and that is a challenge.
And can you tell us more about the science? Because it seems like that's probably also something that often changes a lot and might also be impacted, I suppose, by outside influences like big food lobbies and things like that. I mean, is that difficult to negotiate, kind of changing evidence or disputes?
That's really interesting. And I think there is that perception out in the public that the science always changes. And as I said earlier, I've been working in this area now for 30 years. And largely what we've told people about what are the best foods to eat for their health hasn't changed a lot in the last 30 years. There's probably been some small changes. When I first started, we knew that we thought that dietary fat was problematic and that we needed to limit dietary fat intake. But what we found over, the next couple of decades was that it wasn't the total amount of fat in the diet that was problematic. It was the types of fat in the diet that were problematic. And that's probably one area that has changed a lot. But when we look at the other components of the diet, we've always known that fruit and vegetables are great and they're really important for our health. We've also known that breads and cereals and high fiber breads and cereals or grains are also really important for our health. But what we're understanding through the science is why they're important. So we're understanding more about why we need to eat them as opposed to how much or that we should eat them. We've always known that, but we're just getting the story clearer about why they're good for us and what they have in them and how that interacts with our body, the physiology and the biochemistry to improve our health. And I guess a lot of came out about food and health with COVID-19. And not surprisingly, people were trying to know what can they do to, you know, protect themselves. And the reality with food and our immune system is that there is no one food that's going to improve your immune system. It's basically the whole food pattern, everything we eat that contributes to a healthy immune system. And once again, as I said before, we know that a really high intake of fruit and vegetables and breads and cereals are the critical components of having a healthy diet that will facilitate a healthy immune system. And reducing the intake of those foods we call here in Australia, the sometimes foods, the discretionary foods, you know, things like cakes and lollies and chips and hamburgers, and all those are things that we need to limit how much we're consuming and focus on whole foods.
Yeah, and it seems like maybe food is also one of those things that, you know, we put so much emphasis on being the key to health. I mean, what I mean by that is, you know, when we feel sick, we often think about, oh, have I eaten something? Like that's the immediate thing that
yes.
That's the trigger. And in the same way, it's like, well, eating exactly the right things is the key to me getting better from this illness or preventing this illness, like as if that's the kind of absolute center of.
Yeah, yeah. And a lot of people do think that, and that might be tied up with the memories of when we were ill, when we were young, and what our mum and dad cooked for us. So, you know, if we were sick, I know when I was little, if I had a gastro, my mother would always give me chamomile tea with honey in it. And so whenever I feel a little bit sick, I like having chamomile tea and honey. And it's probably more for the memory of remembering, you know, the comfort I got when I was unwell as a child and that I was being cared for. So, you know, the chicken soup, you know how people always talk about chicken soup for when you're sick. It might be just as much about the memory of someone preparing it for you and preparing it for you with love that is also important. So, you know, that's where you get emotion tied up into food. And I think that's what makes food really, really interesting is that it evokes such strong memories of earlier times, perhaps when we were happier. I use that word happier very loosely because, you know, I guess we're always happy. But, you know, in a time of COVID when we were having to be locked down and we can't go out, our mind goes to better times where we're seeking the better times in our past and, you know, we're being nostalgic. And what did we eat when we were little? You know, oh, maybe if we made some of that, that would make us feel better because I remember my mum or my dad would make that. So let's try making some of that with the kids now. So there's it is quite complex, isn't it? Food is a complex thing. It nurtures us physically quite clearly, but then perhaps it also nurtures us mentally with the memories that are associated with it.
Yeah, and I mean, I want to talk more about what you've noticed about people's diets during the lockdowns and during COVID-19 broadly. I mean, have you noticed that things have changed and maybe for the worse, maybe for the better?
Yeah, no, that's an interesting one because it's hard to know exactly what people have been doing, but there have been some studies here in Australia looking at it. And it's probably a bit of a mixed bag, and I'm combining that with what I see on social media. But of course, what we see on social media doesn't represent what's happening everywhere, does it? So that's the thing we've got to remember. But certainly, you know, there are reports that a lot more people did home cooking. And I think sourdough bread was the thing that everybody tried to cook, right? Yeah. There was sourdough madness. So, you know, some people went, and this is what we saw in a study that was published, that some people went more into cooking food because they had more time. You know, suddenly they were at home, they didn't have transit time into work, or it filled up the time you know, previously you may not have had time to, you know, cook meals such as roasts or slow cooked meals, but suddenly people being at home, they had time to explore these different recipes, perhaps different cuisines, perhaps things that, that you know, they remember their parents or grandparents cooking. But then on the other hand, you also heard that people went to snacking a lot and, you know, their favourite snacks and whatever they are would have become, you know, more likely. And people were talking about the trip to the kitchen and how could they stop themselves from always snacking on foods and setting strict timelines around it. The other thing we've noticed is that there was a lot more advertising of the home delivery services. So while some people wanted to cook more because they had the time, some people still don't have those cooking skills to be able to cook for themselves. So they were probably looking at having to get more takeaway and using, you know, the delivery services that are available. So it was probably a mixed bag for everyone. And it would be interesting to see if anyone continued eating as they normally did and maintained that routine they had beforehand. So, you know, I think my guess is most people probably something changed, be it more home cooking, more snacking, more, you know, home deliveries, you know, more trying old recipes, more trying new recipes. But it seemed like a lot of people wanted to connect with food because basically we probably only felt that was the only thing we had. So, you know, people had Zoom coffees, they had Zoom drinks, and, you know, it was interesting because people were going, oh, what are you drinking? You know, what sort of coffee? Have you got tea or coffee? And, you know, and then if you're having drinks with friends who you'd normally catch up with, oh, which bottle of wine have you opened? Oh, what cheese have you got to eat alongside it? So we're always innately interested in food. And, you know, I guess in a bit, you know, the mass internalization, sorry, I have said that word wrong, you know, the things that caused COVID-19 to spread so quickly in terms of people going from one place to another through, you know, travel, is probably also the thing that allows us to be connected to people with the internet as well. So, you know, that development of our society where we could connect with people and the only thing we had to connect with them a lot of times was food. You know, and what we were cooking, you know, when the sport was down, we couldn't talk about what was happening in the footy or the soccer or the cricket. We couldn't talk about the latest movie. We could probably talk about Netflix. But, you know, all those other things went and food was one of those last things. But we've always known that food brings people together. I mean, you know, universities, they always say if you want someone to attend meetings, always make sure you tell them there's going to be coffee and biscuits provided alongside. So we know that food brings people together. And the other interesting thing is it brings people together, you know, in the family. So people sitting down and reporting they were eating more family meals. Also bringing neighbourhoods together where people would have drinks, you know, over the driveway, over the fence. But also, I guess, connecting people. And certainly from, you know, my cultural background and my family, the importance of recipes that were made by grandparents and great-grandparents and that you have a connection between the generations through food because this was their recipe. This was the recipe that they cooked. And because you have that nostalgia, we found ourselves going back to those, you know, those meals that represented those, you know, brought back those memories of being with those people. So,
It's so interesting to hear your thoughts on this. I mean, as you were speaking, I was thinking about how, for me, I feel like food has been the most profound thing in the lockdowns that's changed for me in my life because I didn't used to cook much at all and, you know, I ate out like multiple times a week. And now my partner and I cook every night. We even like when we're not locked down, we just cook. And we also became really interested in getting like really nice ingredients because that's, you know, we weren't spending money on anything else and
afford
to do that and have these delicious meals all the time. And now I just feel like our cooking's nicer than eating out. So
that's right.
It's so satisfying. I mean, it's a lot of labor, but it's been really positive for my life, I feel like, being able to cook. better and more.
Yeah, and that's an interesting thing, isn't it? I often wonder if people value the food processing system. You know, you buy a croissant. Do you really know how much labour it takes to make a croissant?
Yeah.
I don't know if you tried making croissants. No. But they are really time intensive because there's a lot of rolling of the dough to get that, you know, that lamination that occurs within the croissant. And do we really value those trades that make those foods for us? Because if you've ever made a croissant in your life, you would never throw it out. But I'm sure people would throw out a commercially bought croissant because they don't value the time that goes into it. And so this has, I hope this has implications for how people view food in terms of its link to the environment. And we know that food is a big, you know, the whole food production system is a big input into the greenhouse gases that affect, you know, our environment. So if food was a waste, if food waste was a country, it would be the third biggest emitter of greenhouse gases in the world.
Wow.
Okay. And that's huge. And I always think, do people value it when you see that meal thrown away, when you see that half cup of coffee left behind, and you know the amount of resources, let alone someone's time that's gone into making it? Maybe this is one of the positives that come out of it. People will realise that it's a critical resource, you know. And if this pandemic had been worse in that it had a higher mortality rate and we had to limit movement even more than we already have, how would a country like Australia cope that has huge capital cities that basically a city can't make food for itself? Saying that relies on food coming in from, you know, the rural areas. How would cities cope? There's not many people have gardens anymore. That's probably another thing that's happened, is people tried growing their own produce, you know. They were worried about how could they get food with all the, you know, hoarding of food that was occurring. And so people were starting to grow their own veggies and stuff. So, you know, I think, you know, clearly there's been so much tragedy in this that hopefully some good comes out of it, combined with, you know, the environmental disasters we've seen over this year as well, that people start thinking a little bit more seriously about their food. And the other thing that we know is, you know, if you make your food at home, you're halfway there to a healthy diet, because you're not eating ultra-processed foods. So when I said earlier, you know, hamburger was those sometimes foods, if you make a hamburger at home where you know what goes into the meat mince patty, if you indeed use meat or if you're using an alternative, and you're putting in your own vegetables that you know about, it's way better than getting a, you know, a processed meat burger from outside. Likewise with pizzas, if you're putting good quality ingredients on it and you've made your dough, it's a perfectly healthy meal. So, you know, hopefully people being involved with their cooking means people go back to healthier eating and being more aware of how it's affecting the environment as well.
Mm. Oh, well, that's comforting to know. Yeah. I mean, what about, like, in your practice when you're advising people about nutrition, like, how do you balance those things about the kind of psychological, emotional comfort that comes from certain foods,
yeah,
and the science? Because, you know, like, especially during really difficult times like lockdown, when people are having mental health crises,
yeah,
like, how do you balance those things?
Yeah, that's a good question, because, you know, look, I'm a dietitian, right? But even I need chocolate. So how do you deal with it? And that's a really good question, because our diet is mainly meant to be free of all those foods that people find comfort in. So one thing I do talk about is, well, let's think about carefully. There is, I don't want to say good processed food, but there are some processed foods that will offer more nutrition than others. So we compare potato chips perhaps to a nice dark chocolate. And so, you know, a dark chocolate does contain antioxidants and it does contain flavonoids, which help with reducing, you know, the free radicals that are formed in our body. But of course, you can't have too much of it. And the reason I say dark chocolate is because of the concentration of the cocoa powder in it is so much higher. You get more of them. You're not going to get enough if you're eating milk chocolate. So it's all about making sure people, when I talk to them, they say, look, I really need a chocolate. It's what, well, fine, eat it, but enjoy it when you're eating. There's no point scoffing that chocolate down and not enjoying it and then feeling guilty afterwards. So, you know, have some, really enjoy it, savour the taste of it, you know, perhaps buying individually packaged ones so that you don't eat it all, or buying really good quality chocolate that is more expensive but tastes better and means because it's pricey, you're not going to buy as much of it compared to a, you know, a cheaper brand of chocolate. But then also, you know, going, well, do you find comfort in other foods? You know, like does a bowl of, we're going back to the chicken soup, right? But does a bowl of chicken soup help you? You know, and really evaluating your feelings about once you've eaten that food, does that make you feel as good as you thought it would? And being aware that sometimes it's the advertising that goes with it that attracts us to eating it. So, I mean, we've probably heard, everyone's heard the expression soul music, the music that kept us going in times of a lot of hardship. And we also like to think of soul food. So, you know, the foods that kept you going in the hard times. And a lot of people, you know, is that soul food really those, you know, snack foods? Or is it another meal like a roast or a soup like a pumpkin soup? Or is it a curry? Or is it meatballs? Is it a bolognese? So really thinking about what meals are those that make you feel good when you are feeling quite bad. But certainly, you know, it's not about saying don't eat those foods. It's about, well, eat all the healthy foods that you need that we know are really important for health, and then enjoy that that piece of chocolate or that glass of wine or that little bit of port or, you know, whatever it is that you feel you need at the time, but balancing it all. And, you know, I think if people really sat down and thought about it, the chips and the soft drink might not be the ones that make them feel better. It might be some other food.
Well, I wonder also, with these different patterns that are formed during COVID-19, whether people will have bad associations with some of the things they've relied on. Like maybe there'll just be this complete rebellion against sourdough in the coming years.
That's right. Yes. And we'll be telling stories to our grandchildren. I remember during COVID-19, we made sourdough and I don't ever want to see it again.
Yeah, absolutely. I can definitely imagine that. No, you go.
No, that's good.
So, I mean, just to kind of finish, I wanted to ask about what you think things might look like if we get to a kind of post-pandemic space, which, you know, obviously feels difficult right now. But, like, do you think that there will be long-term changes around taste?
Oh, I don't know. Look, I think there were changes that were already happening. I think one of the big changes that we're seeing in the younger generations is reducing the intake of animal foods, either for environmental reasons or philosophical. So I think there's a lot of change going there. That's a difficult question. I hope there is. I hope more people realise the value in food. I hope more people realise the importance of eating meals together. So, you know, one of the enjoyable things for me when we were in lockdown was that I was at home having lunch with the family, which I never have because, you know, the kids are normally either at uni or at school. So actually having lunch together was, you know, was a thrill, even if it was just sandwiches. There's nothing wrong with sandwiches, but, you know, typically that may not be the meal that people think they would eat together. But just being together for another meal, I found really, I really appreciated because I know that wouldn't ever happen again. You know, that we would be back only having, you know, dinner and weekend meals together. So I hope that people realise the importance of eating meals together, that it brings people together, you know, and finding ways to combat loneliness for people who were alone. Because I think for those that were really doing lockdown hard and alone, they've probably realised how important companionship is. And as we've always said, food brings people together. So I hope that's one outcome, because there seems to be a little bit of evidence that, well, there's a lot of evidence that loneliness is a problem. And so if you can at least getting people to eat meals together, that would be great. I hope people re-look at the impact of the big food companies on how they potentially impact on the foods we eat. You know, a lot of times, whilst all the ingredients are in there and labelled for us to know what we're eating, to also appreciate that some of these ultra-processed foods have a big impact on the environment and may in fact be what I like to think of as cultural disruptors. So going back to those foods that certain cultures ate and learning how to cook them and realising how important it is to know how to cook meals so that you've got something to identify with and learn skills and pass them on to your family. Because, you know, cooking is a really critical, important skill. It's may not be a time saver, as we both found out, Hannah, but certainly in terms of saving money and getting better quality food, if you know what you're putting into your meals, that's a whole lot better. And I think those values probably align with what we hope our society would be anyway, in all aspects, that, you know, it brings us together as a community more so. We think of each other more, and our neighbourhoods, and the different communities we live in, be they our neighbours or our workplace or our sporting, whatever it is. But yeah, I think food's crucial in that, and also having a more sustainable food system where people start growing little bits at home, even if it is just herbs that they're growing or a couple of fruit trees, or, you know, if they've got enough space, having a few chickens running around in the backyard, because that's a really good way of using up food waste and getting eggs from it, which is a really good, nutritious food. So perhaps I'm being a bit nostalgic going, I'd like it to be how it was when I was younger as well, and the value I saw in that, in how food tied together families and communities.
Well, I think it's lovely. It sounds very hopeful, and I think it's really nice note to end on. So thank you so much for your time today.
Oh, my pleasure, Hannah.